Hello and welcome to the Grok Science Show. My name is Samantha Thomas, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Nicholas Epley about what is perhaps a uniquely human ability, to imagine what other people are thinking and feeling, and to sometimes be right. Dr. Epley is professor of behavioral sciences at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business and author of the 2014 book MindWise. He'll tell us about mistakes we consistently make when predicting what's happening in the minds of others and whether we can improve this skill.
So my name is Nicholas Epley. I'm a professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, and I study mind reading. Not the spooky or magical new agey kind of mind reading, but rather the kind of mind reading we do every 5 minutes of our lives and every social interaction that we have, where we think about what other people believe, what they want, what they feel, what their intentions are, what their goals are, what their motives are. We study that scientifically.
And your work generally, and particularly the book, is about our ability to understand what other people are thinking and feeling, and I maybe should say lack of ability, because you really focus on where we fall short.
Yeah, so we have, as human beings, a particularly remarkable mental ability, and that is we're able to think about the minds of others. As far as we can tell, there's no other species on the planet that is able to do this like human beings do. It enables us to cooperate and compete with other people effectively. It seems to undergird our enormous social systems that we live in. But when put to the hard test, it doesn't seem to work as well as we think it does. This doesn't mean that we're terrible at understanding each other, knowing what others think or believe or feel or want, but it means that we're not quite as good as we think we are. So, for instance, when we bring people into the laboratory and ask them to do something that seems pretty simple, we ask people to predict, we take a picture of them and then ask them to predict how attractive they will be rated by a member of the opposite sex. And then we bring in members of the opposite sex who actually rate how attractive they think you actually are. We find no correlation between those two judgments. That is, people seem totally unable in this particular experiment to predict how attractive they're going to be seen by a member of the opposite sex. This even extends this challenge of understanding other minds, even extends to the people who we think we know the best, namely to our spouses. So in one experiment that we conducted over at the Museum of Science and Industry here in Chicago, we brought married couples into the laboratory and asked them to play something like the newlywed game for science. They weren't actually newlyweds. Our spouses in this experiment were married on average for about 10 years. And what we did was we separated them into two rooms. One member of each couple we asked to fill out a questionnaire of 20 different attitude items, asking them questions like, I often feel that our family is too heavily in debt. And the scale would run from -3, strongly disagree with that statement, to +3, strongly agree with that statement. And they would just report how much they agreed or disagreed with that statement. We had 20 such items. And one couple reported their actual attitudes, member of the couple reported their attitudes, and the other member of the couple predicted what their partner would say. Now, you'll be happy to know that after 10 years of marriage, our married couples did predict each other's attitudes at better than chance levels. So out of 20 items, for instance, on a 7-item scale, we would expect our married couples to be exactly right, that is to predict the exact response of the partner, about 3 out of 20 times. That's just by chance. Our married couples were better than that. They got, on average, about 5 out of 20 correct. So not markedly better, but a little better. But what was interesting for us was we asked one member of the couple, the member who predicted the spouse's response, we asked them to predict how many they thought they got correct on this questionnaire. And they didn't say 5. Instead, what they said was 12.6. That is, they thought they had predicted a large number of these items correctly, when in fact they were only slightly better than chance. And that's a finding that we get over and over and over again in our experiments, that however good we are at reading the minds of other people, knowing their attitudes or beliefs or intentions or emotions, we tend to think we're better than we actually are.
So I'd like to know the extent that people vary in their social sensitivities. I mean, we all know people who can read us better than we'd like, and those who are maybe not as perceptive. But can you talk about that? I mean, in your study, the newlywed game, were men different than women?
So in that study, no. In fact, they were not. There are gender differences in this. and that is that women tend to be a little better than men are, but that effect is not very big. And it's not horribly consistent across experiments. And what's more, it seems to disappear when men and women are incentivized to try hard. That is, the difference seems to be that women tend to be more interested in other people spontaneously than men are. But when you incentivize people to get the right answer, those gender differences tend to go away. And they weren't that big to begin with. So in our experiments and others, if you look across the field, the gender differences and things like social sensitivity, the ability to monitor somebody else's emotions and to predict them accurately, for instance, the effect sizes on those, if you convert them into a statistic, are about 0.2. This is equivalent to a correlation where 1 would be a perfect correlation and 0 would be no correlation at all. The gender differences is equivalent to about an effect size of 0.2 or a correlation of about 0.2. But if you ask people to predict how big that gender difference is, they don't say 0.2. They give you an estimate that's closer to 0.7. It's much, much bigger, 2 or 3 or 4 times even bigger than the actual effect size. And I think that's generally true about individual differences across different contexts and among individuals. They aren't horribly reliable. And I spend very little time in the book talking about individual differences. One, because I don't think they're horribly stable. People, you know, when you try harder, you tend to do a little bit better. The biggest individual difference we know of that predicts accuracy in a lot of these mind reading tests is just simple IQ. These are hard problems, and so the higher your raw G, your measured IQ is, the better you tend to be. But even that effect's not very big. It's about 0.3. So that's not that strong. But what's more, these individual differences don't really tell you much about yourself, right? So finding out that you're better than others doesn't tell you where you might make mistakes or where you might fall short. And it also tells you nothing about what you might do to be better. Mm-hmm. Right? So, you know, that you tend to be, you know, a little bit better than the average doesn't explain how would you do even better.
Do you ever look at, just to tease this out a little more, do you ever look at the same person in different states, like, for instance, drunk or well-caffeinated or tired or in love or, you know, whatever?
We don't, although I do like, I have run studies with drunk people before, but never studies where we have followed them as they've gotten drunk. I rather like the thought of that methodology. But we haven't done it. In part, I mean, you can think about the challenges of running a study like that, and it will become pretty clear to you why we don't do that. Running longitudinal studies with people across different contexts, right, where we can manipulate what state they're in, is not a very easy thing to do. And we tend not to do it. Instead, the approaches that we take are we randomly assign people to different conditions to be in different states, and then we measure across participants. That's the more typical approach that we use.
I see. There were a couple things that I wanted to go back to that you said before we go further. The first one is you said that we were the only species that can do this, and I wonder if you kind of generally structure your thinking about psychology around evolution. Some people kind of think about why we might have developed certain behaviors or abilities in the context of surviving in a group. And I was wondering if you thought about that.
Well, I do think a lot about that because it's hard to come up with another grand theory that explains the diversity of life that we see on the planet. However, I don't find it very helpful typically in making specific predictions in our experiments. For one thing, we're trying to reason about a state of the world that none of us were actually in to try to make predictions about what people are likely to do today. None of us were living on the planet during the Pleistocene, and so it's easy to make hand-wavy kinds of stories about what we evolved to do or the conditions that we evolved in. But I'm not very good at doing that kind of anthropology, and I don't think many of my colleagues are either, and so I'm always a little bit suspicious about it. That said, there are some great psychologists who are doing really interesting work thinking about the implications of evolutionary kinds of processes for how we might live our lives today. I just tend not to use that lens typically when thinking about human behavior. I think there are much more proximal determinants that are more important in explaining or understanding what somebody's likely to do in any given moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it might be interesting to think about why we're so bad at it, right? When presumably evolution could have given us the chance to be much better at it, or could have just made people more open about their emotions, where you don't need to read their minds, right? There must be something there.
Well, look, I do think there is something there, and what's there is language. That is the tool that we've evolved to overcome our mind-reading gaps. I mean, being able to understand what's on the mind of another person is a remarkably useful tool. It's a remarkably useful thing. I can figure out who I should cooperate with and who I should not cooperate with. I can learn who knows what out there in the world. So if I need to know some bit of knowledge, I know who to go to. That's enormously useful. And we've developed a tool to do that. It's called language. Person's mind generally comes through their mouth, and the more often we use that, the better we are at knowing another person's thoughts or beliefs or attitudes. And I think that's the main reason why we have that particular ability. But again, there, I don't know that evolutionary theorizing really gives me new insight into that. Not that I'm not open to it, I certainly am. It's just that that's not where my mind goes in thinking through these sorts of problems. There is one other comment worth making, though. I don't think that we're terrible at this. I don't think that we're terrible at understanding the minds of others. I just think we're less than perfect. And so it's a hard problem, a really hard problem. I don't know what your attitudes or your beliefs are. I don't know what your inner emotions are like. I don't know what it's like to be hungry when I'm full. That's a hard thing to do. We've developed some tools that get us better than chance at this that no other species has been able to evolve. That's a remarkable advancement and probably good enough to be a huge advantage for us as a species on the planet. It doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be better than the alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
That's the important thing for understanding evolutionary processes.
So we start somewhere when we're trying to infer what other people are thinking, right? You say egocentrism is a great place to start when reasoning about the minds of others, but it's a terrible place to stop, right? So is egocentrism a good approach to begin with by kind of assuming people are want the same things as us or are thinking?
It is. The fact of the matter is that most of our minds, most of the time, our minds are similar to others. That is, if I've just watched a movie and I think it's horrible, it's just atrocious, a terrible movie, it's a pretty good bet that you're going to find it terrible too. Maybe not every bit as terrible as I am, but it's a pretty good signal to use. Most of the time, human minds operate similarly. And so it is not a bad place to start at all. If I eat this ice cream, this new flavor from Ben & Jerry's, and it just tastes like vomit to me, it's a pretty good indication that it's going to taste like vomit to you.
It's probably not Ben & Jerry's.
Well, it may not be, no. But it's not going to be a bestseller, is a reasonable assumption. But we also know that the world is a complicated place. And if you've ever been on a jury, for instance, in a courtroom, and spent days and days listening to the same kind of testimony, only to hear that your other jury members heard things in exactly the opposite way or interpreted things in exactly the opposite way that you did, you know that your perspective on the world also matters. And so, as I said, it's a good place to start, assuming that others will see the world as you do, but a lot of the mistakes we make come from failing to recognize when, in fact, others are going to see the world differently than you do.
You don't believe that the best we can do is just to account for the fact that we're not perfectly understanding each other and that we probably never will, right?
No.
You believe that we can actually improve this ability.
I do.
Tell us.
You ask people. So I considered three different approaches to this, just described three different approaches in the book to this. One approach is trying to read other people better. That is, trying to read their body language, their facial expressions, their emotions from their body language more accurately. The data suggests that's actually not a very good approach, mainly because our body language just doesn't reveal nearly as much as we think it does. So when you're lying or telling the truth, for instance, you know what your intentions are. And the data suggests that people feel that their intentions are leaking out on their faces or in their bodies more than it actually is. Our bodies just don't reveal nearly as much as we think it does. But it's a compelling intuition. And so the TSA, the Transportation Security Authority or Administration here in the United States, created a program called the SPOT program, which was intended to train behavioral detection officers to read people's subtle nonverbal cues, things that they give away that they thought would reveal the fact that you were hiding or concealing something. They trained 3,000 officers, roughly, in how to do this kind of behavioral detection. They stationed them at a little over 160 airports. The problem is that it doesn't seem to work very well. So during a four-year period that they were investigated, trying to validate this approach, 2 billion people passed through these 161 airports. They detained 151,000 of them for further questioning. Out of those 151,000, 14,000 were followed up for further questioning. And out of those 14,000, 1,083 were arrested. So out of 152,000, 1,083 were arrested. That's a small number. That's less than 1%. What's more, so that's a huge false alarm rate, over 99% false alarm rate. What's more, out of those 1,083 people, the most common offense was what they refer to as illegal alien, that it was some immigration issue. As far as we can tell, this SPOT program that allowed you to try to encourage officers to read subtle nonverbal behaviors was just a really expensive way of enabling racial profiling, as far as we can tell. So reading body language doesn't seem to be the secret. There's no data to suggest that we can get markedly better at reading body language, mainly because our bodies don't reveal as much as we think that they do. The second approach I considered was perspective taking. Right, so maybe I could learn to put myself in your shoes. So you're interviewing me right now, and I can try to figure out what you're thinking or feeling by trying to imagine what I would feel like if I was interviewing somebody else. Or if I'm rich, maybe I can figure out what it's like to be poor by trying to put myself in the shoes of a poor person as best I can. Or if I'm on the opposing side from somebody in a negotiation, I can figure out what they want by trying to put myself in their shoes. This is a long-standing strategy that's presumed to be effective in creating some insight. But again, the data here suggests that it actually doesn't work as well as we think. So in some of our experiments, when we encourage people to put themselves in another person's shoes, it actually decreases accuracy. It doesn't increase it. So in competitive negotiations, when you put yourself in the mind of an adversary, it turns out that you're not imagining that person's actual mind. You're not really able to imagine what their interests, what their motives, what their intentions are. Instead, you rely on stereotypes that in fact exaggerate the difference between the two of you. That actually undermines accuracy in those cases. And so perspective taking doesn't seem to be the secret because it relies on information that you already have. It doesn't give you any new information. So as far as we can tell, it doesn't make you systematically better. The only thing we find that actually increases accuracy is what we refer to as perspective getting. There's no magic in this. There's no secret in this. There's no mumbo jumbo. I'm afraid I can't be a guru on this. But what increases accuracy is actually being in somebody else's perspective, is actually being in their shoes. If you're rich and you want to know what it's like to be poor, you have to be poor for a stretch, and then you'll figure out what it's like. So putting people through simulations, for instance, that simulate what it's like to be poor, really give people an insight into what it's like to be poor. If you want to know what it's like to be waterboarded, for instance, you should not try to guess, which judges in the United States are required to do. You should actually try it. Then you figure out what it's like. Christopher Hitchens did this famously for Vanity Fair, wrote an amazing piece on what this experience was actually like. He had nightmares about this for over a month, his particular experience. The other way that you can get somebody's perspective is by asking them directly what they think or what they believe, and then they can tell you. Language, and the language that people use, is the closest that you're going to come to the mind of another person. This is why presidential elections, for instance, are no longer a surprise in this country. It's because pollsters have become very good at calling people, asking them who they're going to vote for, writing it down, and then running the numbers. That's what we know. That's how we know what people are going to do before they actually do it, as we ask them. Criminal interrogators, for instance, have learned in recent years that the most effective way to get information out of other people is not to apply the thumbscrews method, not to put them through really difficult or humility-inducing kind of experiences or through mild forms of torture. Instead, it's to put them in a situation where they can tell you honestly and openly what they think by trying to reduce the fear that they have for telling you the truth. That's what seems to do it. And so if you want to understand the truth about somebody's mind, you should ask them what they're thinking, not necessarily why they're thinking that. So when a pollster calls you up and asks you who you're going to vote for in an upcoming election, and they do so anonymously, where they try to encourage you to respond as honestly as you can, they ask you, if the election was held today, who would you vote for? You can give a pretty good answer to that. If they ask you, why are you voting for this person? Accuracy may go out the window there. You don't necessarily know why you do that. And so pollsters don't tend to ask you that because they know that you don't necessarily know the answer.
Now that's your next book.
That's the next book. That's right. How do you get people to know how their mind actually works? That's the next one. Yeah.
You put them in an fMRI machine, right? So,
let's not go there.
I would like to go there. This is a science show, and I know you do a bit of brain imaging in some of your studies. Let's talk anatomy. Where do these things live in your brain? I read, what do you call it? The social life organ is your medial prefrontal cortex. How does that help you make inferences about others' minds?
Well, this is the part of psychology that people sometimes refer to as light bright psychology. We put you in a scanner, we ask you to do certain things, and we see what parts of your brain light up. I actually don't. I'm not particularly interested in anatomy. I know some people are, but that's not my area of expertise. In much the same way that I don't think learning about individual differences really gives you anything horribly useful for your daily life, so too finding out where something happens in your brain, the geography of your brain, might be interesting, but it's not particularly informative to you for what you would do to do better or where you might make mistakes. It is good, though, for the science, for adjudicating certain kinds of claims about how the brain works. And that's where it's a really interesting tool, but it's no more than a tool that's used for those kinds of purposes. I think it's really interesting outside of the field of psychology because we are all intuitive dualists a little bit. That is, we think that the mind and the brain are somehow separate from each other. Paul Bloom has made this argument, the psychologist at Yale. We're all intuitive dualists like this. And so when a psychologist can point out, look, it happens in the brain, somehow that seems amazing to us intuitively. But what's the alternative? Right? Where else could it happen? Right? You find out that thought is not localized in the foot. Well, of course that's true, right? People's sense of themselves shows up right here in the brain. Well, yes, it does. It's got to happen somewhere in the brain. Finding out where it is, I don't know how useful that is for most of the things that we think about. It doesn't really make you understand any more what it's like to be somebody else by learning about where their brain lights up.
So let me defend you for a minute from yourself. And defend some of the studies you do. You have a couple studies on people's perception of God. And I'm going to briefly summarize one of your experiments. It involved putting participants in fMRI machines and prompting them to think about their own moral code or beliefs, and then those of the average American. And it turns out these two notions live in different regions of the brain or activate different networks. You then asked people to consider God's beliefs, and it looks like it activated the same region as considering one's own moral code.
God lives in the same place in your brain, at least in terms of beliefs. If you ask people about their beliefs on things like abortion or the death penalty or support for gun control, There is a correlation between their own beliefs and what they think the average American believes, but that's on the magnitude of a correlation of about 0.4. somewhere in that ballpark. So much bigger than zero, but less than one, so it's not perfect. But when we ask people in our experiments to tell us what they think God believes, what we found was that the correlation was closer to 0.7 or even higher. That is, people tended to think that God believed what they believed. Now, this could be because of one or two reasons. One is that this is true only for people who are religious. People who are not religious don't have a very strong correlation between what they believe and what they think God believes. It's the same magnitude of the correlation as it is for the average American. But for believers, this could happen in one of two ways. One thing is that they could be egocentric, that is, they could create God in their own image and assume that God shares their moral code. But the opposite could also happen, that is, people are persuaded to change their mind by religious teaching. They come to see things in ways that their religion believes is right or wrong. And so it could happen that way, too. To test between these two things, notice the neuroimaging study doesn't do that, but to test between these two ideas, we put people in experiments where we change their beliefs. That is, we persuaded them to change their moral beliefs a little bit. And what we found was that people's beliefs about God's beliefs moved around in lockstep with theirs, but people's beliefs about the average Americans didn't. So at least to some extent, people create God in their own image. The neuroimaging study that we did just demonstrated that the neural regions that are involved in thinking about God's beliefs and your own beliefs are, as far as we can tell, the same. We cannot differentiate between them in a scanner.
The second study you pointed out supports the theory that your understanding of God's beliefs are self-referential, right? As opposed to the other way around. Because as yours changed, God's changed.
Now, I should say we did not test the degree to which the other hypothesis is true. That is, we did not manipulate what people thought God believed to see how their own beliefs shifted in line with that. Surely that happens too. What we know from our experiments is that at least God can move around with people's own beliefs. So to some degree, for religious believers, God is somebody that's created in their own image.
Yeah. I'd like to, kind of related to that, talk about inferring minds maybe where there are not minds, objects or something, and the opposite. I think you call it dehumanization, but kind of robbing people of the concept of a mind when clearly they have one. So can you talk about those two phenomena?
Yeah, I think the errors that we make in thinking about the minds of others come in two varieties. One are errors of enactment. When I'm trying to think about what your thoughts actually are, there are a number of heuristics or mechanisms I use to make those predictions. Those can at times lead me astray. But the other class of errors comes one step even before we get to that. These are errors of enactment. Like breathing, mind reading is something that comes and goes. You can take in a breath, but you can hold your breath as well. You don't have to use it at a given time. The same thing is true with our ability to think about the minds of others. It's an ability that gets turned on at times and not necessarily at other times. And so there are times, and these are cases of dehumanization, where mostly because of psychological distance, that is being far removed from somebody else, either in physical space or just feeling that somebody's really different from you, this ability to engage with the mind of another person just isn't enacted at all. And those situations lead to the problematic consequence of, at times, coming to think that somebody else doesn't really have a mind at all, or being totally indifferent to the mind of another person. The opposite set of circumstances come when, usually because some agent or something trips our ability to think about the minds of others, it has big eyes, or it's right close to us, or it talks to us in a voice, we can see at times a mind where no mind actually exists, in a car, in a computer, in a cell phone, and we refer to these phenomena as cases of anthropomorphism, cases where you attribute a human-like mind.
The future of medicine, some people think, will be a computer giving you a diagnosis. Which is jarring, I think, in some ways. But I recently saw a news article saying that computers are actually better at reading facial expressions than we are, and knowing when somebody's lying or lying about being in pain. Yeah, how could that be? I mean, are we just programmed to believe people? Maybe, I don't know.
Well, notice that, well, part of that's right. So one of the mistakes that we make in reading laws are that we assume a truth bias. That is, we assume people are telling the truth, that their thoughts match their actions more simply than they actually do. But notice with a computer, those are not devices that come out of nowhere. We program those. And so I can crunch a huge amount of data about you and about your facial expressions that allow me to back out from your facial expressions what predicts lying and telling the truth. And then I can use that to predict your behavior down the road. And a computer is not fooled by irrelevant information. They're not fooled by stuff that's useless in the same way that human beings can. And so you can design a computer in a way that's maximally accurate and that crunches more data than human beings are capable of doing. And so I don't know that it's so much of a surprise, but notice the fact of the matter is in those experiments, computers are more accurate because they control the stimulus. That is, they show you a video of somebody telling a truth or a lie. And in a context like that, where you as a human being are not able to interact with the person, I can design a computer that's likely to be better. But notice that no computer can come up on the fly with questions, things for me to ask you. It cannot interact with you in nearly as sophisticated a way as a human being can. And so, you know, you always need to take these kinds of findings with a little bit of perspective. Computers can do great things, but there are certain things that they can't do. Asking questions is one of them, and designing themselves is another.
And I just thought of when you were talking that, you know, I'm not sure we ever get really great feedback on when somebody is lying. You know, with this example, I'm sure you tell the computer whether you were really in pain or whether you were really lying.
Right.
And maybe if we got that kind of black and white information after we saw somebody's facial expression, we would then improve and learn, right? But we never really know if the person was lying. I mean, sometimes we do, but...
Right. And you don't know what you miss either, right? So there are lots of cases where you took somebody at face value and you believe they were telling you the truth when in fact they were not. Or you believe that somebody was lying when in fact they were telling you the truth and you just never followed up to find out. You can give a computer perfect feedback. It's harder to do that to a person. That is, you can't train up a person in the laboratory with perfect feedback in the same way that you can with a computer. And so that's also a limitation for us. Yes.
Interesting. Now, have you actually seen the show Lie to Me? Because I've seen that a couple episodes of it, and it's kind of cheesy, but it's a pretty interesting show.
It is an interesting show. It's great science fiction.
I just remembered a phrase from your book that body language speaks, but it whispers.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the main idea from Lie to Me too, which is that the idea it's based on work by Paul Ekman, who's a psychologist at the University of California at San Francisco, and some of his pioneering work on what he refers to as micro expressions. And it takes that little nugget of an idea and it just runs wild with it. It assumes that you can become this kind of magical sleuth by noticing and monitoring people's subtle expressions really, really carefully and gain all kinds of accuracy. The data is not there to support that, not even close, not even anywhere near close. But it does make for a great story. It's great fun to watch. You just have to remember it's science fiction. It's not science.
So why don't we wrap up by having you fill in any last gaps, whatever you want to.
So I think most useful and important lesson that I've learned from doing this research over a couple of decades is really a lesson in humility, that our ability to think about the minds of others is a remarkable ability that we all have, but it doesn't work as well as we think, and there's often more to the mind of another person than meets our eyes. And I think approaching the world with that sense of humility, with that awareness that there's more to another person than probably meets your eyes, is a good way to approach your life in general.
Again, that was Dr. Nicholas Epley, professor at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. For more from us, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or visit our blog at grox.net. For Charles Lee, Frank Ling, and the rest of the Grox crew, I'm Samantha Thomas. Join us next week. In the meantime, don't forget to work on those mind reading skills and keep on grokking.